This week the Sixth Sutra is the Vekanasa Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 80, with two parallels, one in Majjhima Agama 209, and also in an independent Chinese translation listed as the Tertial Sutta number 90. This particular sutta is follows on quite closely from the sutta we read last week, the Chula Sakaludai Sutta, Majjhima 79. And actually, we should have discussed it then, and I apologize for not noticing the relevance of that at the time. But I won't. The sutta is only a couple of pages long in its translation, and most of that is similar to the previous sutta anyway, so I won't discuss it in detail. But just to make a few minor points here, or actually one of points is not so minor, but in this sutta, Vekanasa is supposed to be the teacher of Sakaludai, and so he has a similar conversation with the Buddha about this idea of the perfect splendor and so on. The Buddha goes on to teach the five chords of sensual pleasure, and then says a cryptic sentence in the Pali, which is something like, thus sensual pleasures, according to Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, arise through sensual pleasures, but beyond sensual pleasure there is a pleasure at the peak of the sensual, and that is declared to be the highest among them. Now this particular sentence is cryptic in its English translation, it's just as cryptic in the Pali, and is explained in various ways in the commentary. Venerable Anālaya has got a detailed analysis of that, which I won't read through in all of it, but the essence of it is that... I did press the recorder. The upshot of that whole thing, again, without going, it's a bit too much detail to go into it, but the upshot of the whole thing is it seems that what's actually happening, and this is just a bit of a speculation here, but it seems what's actually happening is that Vekanasa is attached to sensual pleasures. The Buddha says, well, compared to those sensual pleasures which you're interested in, there's another sensual pleasure which is much greater. And elsewhere, when this word kamagasukha is used in the suttas, it refers to the Paranimitta Vasovati realm, the highest realm in the Kama Loka. So it seems like the Buddha is about to say, well, this realm is much better than what you're experiencing. But even that, one presumes he would have gone on to say, is nothing compared to the pleasure of jhana. And even the pleasure of jhana is nothing compared to the pleasure of nibbana. Yeah? But so it seems that the Buddha is about to kind of launch into this kind of discourse, and then, but Vekanasa gets so upset, he interrupts the Buddha, and so that part of it never gets said. And so this is why the text is a bit confusing at that stage. So this is what it seems to be going on here. Vekanasa's interruption, he says that he when he becomes upset, he criticizes the Buddha by saying, it seems that there are some recluses and Brahmins here who, without knowing the past and without not seeing the future, yet claim birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. What they say turns out to be ridiculous, it turns out to be mere words, empty and hollow. And so here Vekanasa is fairly clearly picking up on some statements which the Buddha said to Sakaludai in the previous sutta, where he said, if you knew about the past, if you could recollect your past lives, then we could have discussion about the past, or if you could have the divine eye and see beings passing on according to their karma, then we could have a discussion about the future, but let the past be and the future be, I will teach you the Dhamma. At which Sakaludai then says, I don't know what you're talking about. So it seems that Vekanasa has misunderstood that statement to imply that the Buddha himself had no knowledge of past lives or of the future rebirth, and is then criticizing the Buddha because of that. Now the interesting thing is that the Buddha's response in the Pali version, he says, if this is the case, and recluses and Brahmins claim that, he said, they can be reasonably refuted. Okay? So he implicitly agrees that it's impossible to become an arahant without knowledge of the past and the future, remembering that knowledge of the past and the future, according to the Sakaludai Sutta, referred specifically to the knowledge of recollection of past lives and the possession of the divine eye. Now this particular statement of the Buddha here seems to be in contradiction with the normal position in the suttas, which is that those two knowledges, the recollection of the past lives and the divine eye, are useful and beneficial part of practice, but are not essential for arahantship. Accordingly, in the Chinese versions, you find quite a different presentation. And in the Chinese versions, the Buddha said that, the Buddha indicated that concern with past and future can be dispensed with, as even without recollecting a single birth, it is possible to reach awakening. So this is the statement in the Chinese account. This is quite an interesting, this particular point has been raised in discussions of questions like dependent origination and so on a number of times. So it's interesting that there's quite an important, or at least noticeable, noteworthy difference between the Pali and the Chinese at that point. Point of interest, which I'll just bring up, it talks about the Buddha gives a simile of a young, tender infant lying prone, bound by stout bonds at the four limbs, with the fifth at the neck. And then at the result of his growth and the maturing of his faculties, these bonds were to loosen, and he would know I would be free and there would be no more bondage. It's a somewhat peculiar image. Why were was this poor little baby being tied up with these kind of bonds? And how is it that when he gets up, that somehow the bond grows up, that somehow the bonds are loosened? According to the Chinese version, presentation says that the parents had bound the child's hands and feet, and it suggests that the parents did so in order to prevent the child from harming himself, as can easily happen when an infant is left unattended and is able to move freely. So it's not that he's being cut. It sounds in the Pali, it looks like he's being tortured, but the idea in the Chinese is more that he's just being put in restraints or something like that while the parents are not able to look after him. But just the other interesting thing about this is if the Chinese is talking about binding the feet, of course the well-known practice of binding the feet in China, especially of the girl children, to get them to have small feet, I wonder whether there's any connection there. And it's actually the origin of the story of Cinderella is actually a Chinese story and originated in China in about the 7th or 8th century. This is why in the story of Cinderella that the girl has the one with the smallest feet is the one who wins the handsome prince.
In most cultures, they have
quite possibly, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so that's all I just wanted to comment on this sutta. If anyone has any other questions, I wanted to move on to the Gatikara Sutta, which is a much more substantial and very interesting one. Does anyone have anything else in the Wekanasa Sutta that they'd like to bring up? Yeah. How do you gain confirmed confidence in the notion of karma without looking at past lives? Well, that's in terms of both the two kinds of knowledge, which is mentioned in the Sanyutta Nikaya. The first is the direct knowledge, pratyatka, of awareness of things in the present moment, and the other one is the inferential knowledge. So an awareness of, when you're aware of things in the present moment, then that teaches you about conditionality, that things are not permanent and that they're conditioned. That's what they call yogi pachaksha, is a technical term of a direct knowledge derived through meditation experience. Yeah. And then the second one is through inference, so you're aware that these the same forces that are applying in the present moment also applied in the past and the future.
Both are required.
So that's inferential knowledge, which is different from the psychic power of being aware of what's happening in past lives. So the simile I like to use is the simile of the television repairman. So if you're sitting there watching a television, you know what's in the program, right? But you haven't got a clue of how the television works. But when the television doesn't work, you call the television repair person, I should say, repair person, to come and fix it. Now, while they're fixing the back, they've got no knowledge of actually what the program is that's on at that time, but they know how the television works. So this is the difference between those two kinds of knowledge. Recollection of past lives is like watching the television program. You know what's actually happening, you know the details of that, and you know the story, but you don't necessarily have any understanding of what's going on. Whereas the recollection according to dependent origination is like the knowledge of the repair person, that they know the how do you say that, repair person? Technician. Yeah. Yeah. So you know how the guts of it work, yeah. But you don't know the details of the program.
No, I don't know. Itself isn't sufficient.
No, the you don't need to know what the program is. You do need to know how it works. Yeah. Yeah. But knowing the program is also can be fun. Okay, where can I start? So I'd like to move on to the Gatikara Sutta. Now, Gatikara Sutta is a very interesting and extremely important sutta for Buddhist history. I'm sorry that I didn't tell you this beforehand so that you could have read up on it in advance. But, sorry?
I read this one, so I wasn't quite sure which one you
had to. Oh, well, that's good. So the Gatikara Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 81, and as you can see here, has quite a few corresponding suttas in the different versions, the Majjhima Agama number 63, an independent sutta, Taisho 197.10. I'm not exactly sure what that sutta is, and what part of the canon it's in. Can you read this? And this one is Charita, isn't this? Is conduct. It's like the, it, could it be the what they call the Buddha Charita? They call the Buddha's conduct, the Buddha's life. Buddha's life, something like that, might be Buddha Charita. Austere practices, okay. Account of the austere practices in the Buddha's life, something like that. Okay, so this is some kind of biographical text on the Buddha's life. And now these ones, these two from the Mahavastu in two different versions, and these are two published in two two accounts. And I'm not 100% sure what the relationship between these two things is. The Mahavastu is a very large and complex text, which we have the translation of it here if anyone's interested in, which is essentially one of the early lives of the Buddha. So we're familiar with the suttas and the process of accumulating stories about the Buddha and so on. And after the Buddha's time, these became assembled into large compendiums where all the legends and stories about the Buddha were put together and assembled into a more or less coherent account of the Buddha's life. Now, this one is firmly on the less coherent side, being a sutta of the Mahasanghikas, who tended to be less than 100% scrupulous in their editorial policies, which is great for textual scholars because they tended to just throw everything in there without worrying too much about making it all consistent and fitting it all in and so on. So Mahavastu is an extremely loosely organized and chaotic telling of the life of the Buddha with all kinds of stuff in there. It's called nominally a Vinaya text, although the Vinaya content of it is minimal. And it's got all kinds of Jataka stories and legends and things. It'll tell the same story in different times, in different places and so on. Now these are two texts here which are listed. They're both in Sanskrit, Mahavastu recovered from Sanskrit. It's actually Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit rather than classical Sanskrit. And I'm not 100% sure whether these two are two separate accounts or whether they're simply the same thing in two separate manuscripts. So it could be that the same story is actually told twice in the Mahavastu and that we have two different accounts of it because of its chaotic organising. But, yeah, I'm not sure what the case is here. It looks like they're both, it says, from Volume 1, so they may be from both the same. So it may be just two different Sanskrit manuscripts of the same passage. And then this is another Sanskrit one from the Sanghabhairavastu. This is from the, as it says here, the 17th and last section of the Vinaya of the Mula Sarvastivadins. So the Mulasavasivada Vinaya was one of the major Sanskrit manuscripts found in Gilgit and since edited and published. Not all of the Mulasavasivada Vinaya was recovered, but very large sections of it were, including this particular sutta. And then the last reference there is from the Tibetan version of the Mulasavasivada Vinaya as well. Curiously enough, there's no mention of the Chinese text of the Mulasavasivada Vinaya here. I wonder whether that's because it's just an omission or whether, in fact, it doesn't have this particular story in it. In any case, we have a very wide spread of this story. It's well attested within the Buddhist tradition and clearly was a popular story and an important part of the Buddhist community's understanding of the life of the Buddha. Now, this particular text, which we'll go on to read in a minute, is extremely important because it's one of the earliest and most authentic versions of what we call a Jataka story. And because it's such an early version of a Jataka story, at almost every point along the way, it grates rather obviously with our received understanding of what a Jataka story should be. And the way that the Buddha behaves and the whole story is in fact quite different from how most of the later Jataka stories appear. And so it's an invaluable piece of evidence of how that the theory of the Bodhisattva and their way of life, the theory of the Buddha's enlightenment and so on, became developed within the Buddhist community, as well, of course, as being a very nice story in its own right. So let's read through the Gadikara Sutta. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was wandering among the Kosalans together with a large sangha of bhikkhus. The Kosala, of course, being the country of which Savatthi is the capital. Then the Blessed One left the main road, and at a certain place he smiled. It occurred to the Venerable Ananda, what is the reason? What's the cause for the Blessed One's smile? Tathagatas do not smile for no reason. Imagine the poor Buddha. Is there such a smile? And they will go, oh God, it must be something really significant. Okay. So he arranged his upper robe on one shoulder, extending his hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One. He asked him, Venerable Sir, what is the reason? What is the cause for the Blessed One's smile? Tathagatas do not smile for no reason. Once, Ananda, in this place there was a prosperous and busy market town called Webhalinga, with many inhabitants and crowded with people. Now the Blessed One Kassapa, accomplished and fully enlightened, lived near the market town Webhalinga. It was here, in fact, that he had his monastery and sat and advised the Sangha of bhikkhus. Then the Venerable Ananda folded his patchwork cloak in four and, spreading it out, said to the Blessed One, Then, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One be seated. Thus this place will have been used by two accomplished ones, fully enlightened ones. Then the Blessed One sat down on the seat, made ready, and addressed. Already reached some interesting kind of Buddhological cruxes here. We have the idea of the previous Buddha, the Buddha Kassapa, and of course this being a standard part of how, as a Buddhist community, the nature of Buddhahood is thought of, that the Buddha is somebody who's unique in a period of time, but in terms of cosmic time, is regarded as merely an instantiation of a paradigm. And so Buddhas appear from time to time, both in the past and in the future. And so the reality of these past Buddhas is, certainly for the few previous ones, is taken for granted in the early suttas. It's taken for granted that we can actually point to a place in India where this previous Buddha had lived and so on. Of course, there's about four Buddhas in this cosmic eon. Previous cosmic eons, of course, it's not possible to do this. The time scale at which the Buddhas appear in is mythological, in terms of, you know, how many hundreds of thousands of years and so on. Interestingly enough, in the Jaina religion, they have a similar idea of the previous, if you like, Buddhas or enlightened ones in their religion, and they too similarly take place in a cosmological time frame, except for the immediately preceding one. And according to the Jains, their immediately preceding teacher lived about 100 or 200 years before the Nigantha Nataputta, who was contemporary of the Buddha. And so it's likely that that was actually a historical teacher. As for the rest of these teachers, we're not talking historical time, we're talking mythological time. And it means that it's a time which is measured or which is important because of the meaning that it has for people, rather than because it can actually be recorded with any... It's not something which would be reported by as fact by a journalist in a newspaper, but it's something which has meaning for a particular community.
So does that mean it may not actually have occurred, or it did occur, but you can't?
Yeah, it means that questions like did it occur or did it not occur can't be answered by ordinary historical means. Does it underline what's happening? I'm not sure what you mean. Absolutely. Yeah. As a mythology, I mean, typically, both stories of the past, legends of the past, and also prophecies of the future, especially, are actually, as you're saying, talking about the present. They're metaphorical or ways of talking about the present, and in some cases they allow you to say things about the present to make vivid things about the present which are not always obvious. So for example, one of the things which is being said through this mythology is that the nature of Buddhahood is not something which is peculiar to a particular individual, even though as far as we can see it is. There's only one individual who's a Buddha. But actually the nature of Buddhahood is a universal quality of humanity, and it's relevant for all humans, not just for these humans in this point of time. So, yeah, in that way it uses as a metaphor to deepen a sense of meaning around the notion of the Buddha.
It's situated in which place someone says, here is a place,
absolutely.
And you've said before, and
yeah.
So, as a Buddhist community, do you take that visually?
Oh, up to you. In this case, what I would say is that if we look at different kinds of truth claims that are made in religion, you see a number of what I would think of as conceptually quite distinct types of truth claims. There are types of truth claims about things which are either true or false, and which it's possible or at least reasonable to be able to investigate and to be able to determine that by normal means which everybody can understand. Okay, so for example, we can say that the Buddha was born in such and such a year in India. Okay, and so it's possible to use archaeology and so on to investigate that kind of truth claim. Okay, there are other kinds of truth claims which are not possible to investigate by widely accepted means like that, but which might possibly be so, and which at least potentially could be susceptible to that kind of inquiry. So that might include things like, say, recollection of past lives, yeah? Where scientific evidence may be dubious or questionable, or even whether it's possible to investigate it scientifically, but at least in theory we can imagine how it could be tested scientifically. And so that then is a field of inquiry. Then there are other kinds of truth claims which are made, which you can't even begin to imagine how they could possibly be tested in any way. So, for example, the claim that God is omniscient and created the world and is all powerful. You can't even begin to imagine how that could be really tested or proved or known in any kind of realistic manner. So I would say that this kind of claim that's being made here falls more or less within that second category. It's entirely plausible to say that there were sages in the past in India. Everyone agrees that. There's images from the Indus Valley 1,000 years or 2,000 years before the Buddha of people sitting in meditation. It's entirely possible that there were great sages, even enlightened sages, in India in the remote past, who were there. Yeah? How that exactly... It's not possible to then link that up to all of the details of how the cosmology is described in terms of the periods of just time and things like that. But they're more the incidental details. But certainly in terms of the general principle, I don't... The basic idea, as it says here, is nothing more than to say that there was an enlightened Buddha who sat in that place in the past.
Do we take that
Oh, certainly, yeah. Yeah. Again, I don't, those kinds of things certainly don't agree with our contemporary scientific knowledge of how civilization has grown and changed. I think there's extremely compelling evidence to show that the appearance of the Buddha occurred not just... In the way that the past is conceived in the Buddhist scriptures, people were more or less like they are in the present. But I think that the actual textual and archaeological evidence of the far past shows that people were actually quite different. I would question whether it's even possible to have a Buddha in those kinds of circumstances. And that's a very complex historical question. Certainly not certain in any way. In modern day context, yes.
I try to separate that from the various numbers that are quoted in sutras. Basically, going back into Buddhism, human, and if you believe evolution,
they're
impossible.
Yeah.
That's what I take to be mythological. It's a mythical sort of concept.
Yeah.
Like lots of numbers,
of course, yeah.
You know, obviously,
they're trying
to get across some sort of conception of time for people who perhaps didn't know anything about mathematics.
Yeah, and the use of numbers. I mean, we still use numbers in that way today. I said, if I've told you once, I've told you 100 times.
Yes.
You know, and. But it's just the tendency is when we read the suttas is that we tend to over-literalise a lot of things. And so, yeah, it's important to not insist too much on these kinds of details. Okay, so but just a little point there that Analia raises up. Blah, blah, blah. According to the Mahavastu, not only the Buddha Kassapa, but also the two preceding Buddhas, Kakusanda and Konagamana, had been seated on this very spot. Okay, so I just raise that little point just to give you an example. This is how the legend develops. And you can see this again and again and again and again, countless times. Every time when you look at these kinds of things, is this tendency to extend everything. It's not just one past Buddha has used this, but actually both, all of the past Buddhas from this eon have all sat on this one place. So this is the way that the tradition builds up this mythology. Again and again and again, this is constantly happening throughout all the different tellings of these kinds of stories. The Buddha sat down and then said to Venerable Ananda, "Once, Ananda, in this place there was a prosperous and busy market town called Webhalinga, with many inhabitants and crowded with people. Now the Blessed One Kassapa, accomplished and fully enlightened, lived near the market town Webhalinga. It was here, in fact, that the Blessed One Kassapa had his monastery and taught the Sangha of Bhikkhus. And there he had a supporter, a chief lay supporter, a potter called Gatikara. The potter had as a friend, close friend, a Brahmin student named Jyotipala. Gatikara, of course, just meaning potter. And in different versions, he's given a different name. I think he's called Nandapala or something. Gatikara and Jyotipala. Uttara, we have the name Uttara, Nandipa, and so on, so a few different names, but anyway. One day, the potter Gatikara addressed the Brahmin student Jyotipala thus, "My dear Jyotipala, let us go and see the Blessed One Kassapa, accomplished and fully enlightened. I hold that it is good to see that Blessed One accomplished and fully enlightened." The Brahmin student Jyotipala replied, "Enough! my friend Gatikara, what is the use of seeing that bald-pated recluse? Okay, so, these points really shouldn't need making again and again, but just to point out that his friend is a Brahmin student. Now, the institution of having a Brahmin student is a cultural phenomenon which has arisen in a certain time and a place. In particular, it's arisen in India, and it's arisen in India as an outcome of the movement of the Aryan-speaking peoples, the Indo-European-speaking peoples, into India and their establishment of an intellectual elite known as the Brahmin caste, who tried to maintain a monopoly on intellectual knowledge in ancient India. And so the very notion of a Brahmin student is tied to a period of time in Indian history which couldn't have extended more than, say, 1,000, maybe 1,500 years before the Buddha, more likely 500 years before the Buddha. And so again, the tellings of these stories are tied down to very local and temporal phenomena, but seen as being universal. And he said, let's go and see him. What is the use of seeing that bald-pated recluse? And again, I'm not going to keep on pointing this out every time, but the another part of the thing is why should he, as a Brahmin student, have a prejudice against summoners? Well, because in India, in the time of the Buddha, the summoners were making a challenge to the Brahmins' religious and spiritual monopoly, so that there was an undercurrent of animosity between the two, which explains why he disliked that. But of course, again, that has its own particular social context. A second and a third time, the Patagatikara said, "My dear Jyotipala, let us go and see the Blessed One Kassapa accomplished and fully enlightened. It is good to see that Blessed One." And a second and a third time, the Brahmin student Jyotipala replied, "Enough, my friend Gatikara, what's the use of seeing that bald-pated recluse? Then, my dear Jyotipala, let us take a loofah and bath powder and go to the river to bathe." "Very well," Jyotipala replied. So the potter Gatikara and the Brahmin student Jyotipala took a loofah and bath powder and went to the river to bathe. Then Gatikara said to Jyotipala, "My dear Jyotipala, oh, there's the monastery of the Blessed One Kassapa, accomplished and fully enlightened, quite nearby. Let us go and see him. I hold that it is good to see him." "Enough, my friend Gatikara, what is the use of seeing that bald-pated recluse?" Interesting that Gatikara doesn't really answer the question, but anyway. And the second and the third time, then the potter Gatikara seized the Brahmin student Jyotipala by the belt and said, "Let us go and see him. I hold that it is good to see the Buddha." Then Jyotipala undid his belt and said, "Enough, what's the use of seeing that bald-pated recluse? Then, when the Brahmin student Jyotipala had washed his head, the potter Gatikara seized him by the hair and said, "My dear Jyotipala, here is the monastery of the Buddha nearby. Let us go and see him." The Brahmin student thought, it's wonderful, it's marvellous that this potter Gatikara, who's of an inferior birth, should presume to seize me by the hair when we have washed our heads. Surely this can be no simple matter. And he said to the potter Gatikara, "You go as far as this, my dear Gatikara." "I go as far as this, my dear Jyotipala, for so much do I hold that it is good to see that Blessed One accomplished and fully enlightened. Then, my dear Gatikara, let go of me, let us visit him." So, of course, his behaviour, Gatikara's behaviour is pretty outrageous in any circumstances, and especially outrageous as a Brahmin student whose hair is regarded as sacred and who's just washed it. Then they went to see the Buddha. Gatikara, after paying homage to him, sat down at one side while Jyotipala exchanged his greetings with him, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he too sat down at one side. Gatikara then said to the Buddha, "Venerable Sir, this is the Brahmin student Jyotipala, my friend, my close friend. Let the Blessed One teach him the Dhamma." And the Blessed One Kassapa instructed, urged, roused and gladdened Gatikara the potter and Jyotipala the Brahmin student with an exposition of the Dhamma. At the conclusion of the exposition, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One Kassapa's words, they rose from their seats, and after paying homage to the Blessed One Kassapa, accomplished and fully enlightened, keeping him on their right, they depart. Then Jyotipala asked Gatikara, "Now that you've heard this Dhamma, my dear Gatikara, why don't you go forth from the home life into home?" "My dear Jyotipala, don't you know that I support my blind and aged parents?" "Then, my dear Gatikara, I shall go forth from the home life into homelessness." Then, so Gatikara the potter and Jyotipala the Brahmin student went to the Blessed One Kassapa, paid homage to him, and then the potter said, "This is my friend Jyotipala, my close friend. Let the Blessed One give him the going forth." and the Brahmin student received the Jyotipala received the going forth from the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. He received the full admission. Then not long after Jyotipala, the Brahmin student, had received the full admission, 1.5 months after that, the Blessed One Kassapa, accomplished and fully enlightened, having stayed at Vebhalinga as long as he chose, set out to wander towards Benares. Wandering by stages, he eventually arrived at Benares, and there he went to live in the deer park at Isipatana. So in this case, he's travelled south. He was previously in the Kosalan country, which is to the north of Benares. He's travelling south, and it's entirely typical of the Jataka stories that they are set in or around Benares. And it seems that Benares was, in the time before the Buddha, was one of the major cities. The generation before the Buddha appeared in the time of the father of King Pasenadi of Kosala, who were familiar with the suttas. So his father invaded Benares, annexed it, and made it a part of the Kosalan kingdom. During the Buddha's lifetime, Benares was warred over by Kosala and Magadha, and eventually absorbed into the Magadhan kingdom. And so it wasn't a sort of independent, powerful kingdom from that period onwards in Buddhist, in Indian history. So typically the fact that Jataka stories are set in Benares is one of those tags or signs that puts it into that period, which we would think of normally historically being 200 or 300 years before the time of the Buddha, is the time of the when Benares was probably the major kingdom around that area. And of course the deer park where the Buddha stayed, where he gave his first sermon. So before going on to tell the story of King Kasi, let's just have a look at Venerable Analia's comments here. Of course, it's a very complex essay here by Venerable Analia because of the number of different versions here.
Does he say that the potter grabbing the Brahmin student or the judge
It isn't it? No. Let's have a look. It just says that according to the Pali count, he seized his hair. Mahavastu said he seized his hair because Jyotipala had pushed him away and started to leave. Okay, so it seems to be a common part of it. Coming back, the Jyotipala in the Pali version says he doesn't want to see the Buddha because it's useless to visit such bald-headed recluses. The Mundakena Samanakena. Okay. Now, the Madhyama Agama discourse and the Sangha Vastu, which of course is the Mulasavasti Vardavinaya, moreover, report that the... I'll explain that. This text that we're calling the Sangha Vastu, as mentioned before, is the 17th chapter of the Mulasavasti Vardavinaya in Sanskrit. Now, Sangha Bheda, of course, means schism in the Sangha. And the Sangha Bheda Vastu starts out in the Pali version and similar versions as being the story of Devadatta and his attempt to cause a schism in the Sangha. Because there's this considerable narrative element in that, and because that narrative element is obviously of great interest, it's a fascinating story, it then attracted more and more narrative to it. So by a curious kind of quirk, by the time of the Mulasarvasi Vardavinaya, almost the entire biography of the Buddha is actually included within the schism section of the Vinaya. Okay, so even though the actual meaning of that is the chapter on the schism in the Sangha, what it actually is a long compendium of the life story of the Buddha, which in fact starts with the turning of the world eons and goes through the establishment of civilization and all of these Jataka stories and everything, and ends up with the life of the Buddha and finally with Devadatta. So this is why this particular discourse is in the Sangha Bheda Vastu. Of course, from the Mulasarvasi Vardavinaya, we can assume that what they've probably done is adopt a version of the Gatikara Sutta, which is taken from the Mulasarvasi Vardan's recension of the the Madhyama Agama. Jyotipala did not believe in Kassapa Buddha's awakening, which he thought to require the undertaking of ascetic practices. Ooh, dear. I do not want to see bald-headed recluses. Bald recluses cannot properly teach the path because the path is difficult to read. And this is the Madhyama Agama version. Difficult path is Dushkara. Parallel passage in the Bodhi here, Parama Dushkara. Buddha's assessment is Dushkarang Charitam. Okay, so this is Analaya's argument. It's a little bit thin. It doesn't seem that the texts are explicitly and definitively stating that it is to be reached by ascetic practices, but it's inferred from this other passage in the Sarvastivada, the Sangaveda Vastu. For 6 years I practiced these hard things to practice, dushkaram. So it's a reasonable inference, but just to be, and then here he's, Gatikara's pointing to the fact that these bodhi is parama dushkara, it's very hard to achieve. So Analaya infers that that means it's only to be achieved by doing ascetic practices. Now, Sangaveda Vastu, together with the Chinese, Pali and Tibetan Apadana and Avadana collections, indicate that Dhotipala's rejection of the possibility to reach awakening without practicing asceticism had dire karmic consequences. Okay, and here's the various references here. Now, another interesting or important point here is that again, remembering that the Sangaveda Vastu, we're talking about the canonical Mulasarvasivada Vinaya, okay? That's the basic text. Now, that has passages here which are parallel not with the Pali basic text, but with the Pali, Chinese and Tibetan Avadanas. Okay? So these are, of course, the later collections of stories about previous lives of the disciples and of the Buddha and so on. So this is, again, something which we find again and again and again in these comparative studies, that the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya in particular is parallel not with the Vinayas of other schools, but with the later collections of Jatakas and Avadanas and so on. So this is one of the qualities of the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya, which has led almost all scholars who commented on the matter to assume that it's a much later compilation than the other canonical Vinayas. That's the one the Tibetans use, yeah. So that doesn't necessarily mean that the Vinaya sections of it are later. And in fact, often the actual Vinaya parts, I was discussing this with Venerable Brahmali yesterday, actually the Vinaya parts in the Mulasarvasivada Vinaya, like the actual analyses of Vinaya rules, are often very slim. They're often very less developed than other Vinayas. Not always, but in many cases they are. So the Vinaya parts may well have been kept from an early Vinaya and may well be early, but the text as a whole has had a lot of later material put in there. Dire karmic consequences, blah, blah, blah. So there's the references here. And when reborn as Gautama, the Buddha to be, as a result of his being, Dhotipala had to undertake ascetic practices himself for 6 years before reaching liberation, thereby having to prove to himself that such practices were indeed not required for awakening. Now, does anybody want to list the number of ways that this contradicts the actual teaching of the Buddha in the early sutras? So first of all, he's having to do all the ascetic practices to get enlightened in order to prove you don't have to do ascetic practices to get enlightened. Okay, that's a good point. Yeah. And of course, in the suttas, what the Buddha says when he's talking to the Jains is, you believe that you're doing these ascetic practices because of what you did in your past lives, but isn't it the case that you feel those painful feelings when you do the ascetic practices? You don't feel those painful feelings when you don't do the ascetic practices. So the painful feelings that you're getting is a result of your practice, your acts here and now, and not because of anything you did in your past lives. So that's the teaching of the Buddha in the Devadaha Sutta and elsewhere. So this kind of problem here in the narrative is very interesting. What it's pointing to is the point that I made at the beginning, that this particular sutta is a story derived from one of the earliest, if not the earliest, kind of text that's talking about the Buddha talking about his past lives and what he did in his past lives. That's a Jataka story. And that is quite different in its nature from what we are given to believe in most of the other Jatakas. Now, of course, what we've seen in this story already is that Gatikara was totally resistant to the teaching. Okay, so remember that according to the developed version of the Bodhisattva theory, and the Bodhisattva countless eons ago had made the decision to go forth and had decided, I'm going to practice the paramis and develop them in life after life after life, leading up to the enlightenment in this life. And so, according to that theory, already for countless lives, he's been systematically developing each of these paramis over and over and over again in his striving to realize arahantship. And now he's reached this point, so to realize Buddhahood, now he's reached this point where only just before his, this is only, you know, in terms of that time frame, this is only, you know, it's just, he had this life and then one other life in heaven or something in Tusita and then got reborn in this, so it's only immediately before he actually gets enlightened. He's completely forgotten all of that. Countless eons of practice is just out the window. So you think it might be frustrating, right? You go on retreat, you do your practice, you come out on a Sunday, and by Tuesday it's all gone, right? You might think that's frustrating. Well, imagine how he felt, right? Billions and billions and billions, as Carl Sagan would say, of years. And that's it. All he has to be pulled by his hair, even to go and listen to a teaching, yeah? And so obviously what we're given here is a kind of behaviour which is quite strikingly different from what we are given to expect in this context. Now then we've got this other behaviour, this other problem of the ascetic practices. Now again, this period of 6 years ascetic practices is recorded frequently in the earliest scriptures and widely distributed across all the schools and so on. It clearly was a part of the early tradition. And yet again, it's quite inexplicable in terms of the idea of developing the paramis for countless eons. Why would he develop systematically the path towards enlightenment for countless eons and then suddenly completely lose the plot immediately before his awakening? Yeah? Not just a little bit of a slip up or something, but 6 years of completely wasted time. And so this is a major crux in the development of the Bodhisattva theory and the development of the Buddhist understanding of the nature of Buddhahood. What we find in different texts in different places is that the traditions will offer a variety of different reasons to explain that particular problem. So, for example, in some places the traditions say the Buddha did those 6 years of practice because he wanted to demonstrate the strength of his energy, and in other places he did that as an example to people of how dedicated they should be. Of course, all these explanations are completely ad hoc, and they contradict the basic Buddha's teaching. Immediately after that, he comes to the group of six monks or the group of five monks and says, "This way is not to be practiced." Right? So he's not giving it as an example. Of course, he's giving it as an example of what not to do. Yeah? He says, "What is not to be practiced?" And moreover, the suttas themselves explain exactly why the Buddha did those 6 years of ascetic practice. And that's mentioned in the, I think, in the Bodhi Raja Sutta, if I remember rightly. And it says that I, in the past, too, believed that pleasure was not to be gained through pleasure. I believed that pleasure was to be gained through pain. So he explains very clearly and explicitly why he did those 6 years of ascetic practices. It's because he thought that to find happiness, he had to experience those 6 years or that period of time of pain. That's the reason. He had a wrong view about the nature of these things, not because of his acts in the past or because of anything else. So what we're seeing here is an inheritance of an early tradition which doesn't agree with the developments in the later tradition, and then the attempts of the traditions to unify all of these things. And of course, these things sound very plausible. If you believe in the tradition and you want to believe it, then you can allow yourself to be convinced. But if you take a critical point of view, then you realize that we're talking about entirely different strata of ideas which don't necessarily agree with each other at all. Now, what that means is, it depends entirely on the kind of assumptions that you bring to the reading of the text. If you bring the assumption to the reading of the text that all of the Buddha scriptures emanate from the Buddha and that they all emanate from enlightened wisdom and that they're all consistent, then you're kind of driven to finding these overall explanatory schemes that can make sense of all of these things. Right? Now, if instead, if you take it from an analytical or from a critical point of view, you say, well, what does it actually mean in that place and that time? What you begin to notice is that it's precisely these junctures of contradiction or paradox which is a source of creativity. Rather than trying to explain them away, but the idea is to look at them and try to understand them. This is a very common feature in just about every kind of long tradition. Just to give a couple of examples here. In the Ramayana, there is a story of the perfect love story, Rama and Sita, like the ideal husband and wife. Yeah, and it's a story of their faith and their love and their devotion for each other. But there's certain points in the Ramayana where Rama behaves like a complete and utter bastard, and where he doesn't trust Sita, even though she's done nothing wrong, and he just kicks her out because of his own concern for his reputation. Yeah? And this has come down since in the earliest versions of the Ramayana. And so every time that story is retold throughout the generations, somehow they have to grapple with this thing. Why did Rama do this? And so this becomes a great source of creativity. Each teller has to reinvent a new reason. Why actually did Rama do that? And so that tells you how the different generations were relating to that particular text. So this is just one example. You can look in different traditions and see many examples. Another example you can see in the Christian tradition where there's, you know, things which Jesus says in the Gospels or attributed to Jesus in the Gospels, where he says, any of you who don't have a sword, get yourself a sword and come with me. You know, then these kinds of things are quite challenging if you want to depict Jesus as a peace lover. So again, how the tradition relates to these points of contradiction and paradox is a source of the creativity and the reinvention of the teaching. Absolutely, yeah.
It's almost like creative and you could avoid practicing the same thing in the future.
Absolutely, yeah.
You just kind of want to go that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So which is, I think, a fundamental part of the whole way it's out of the park.
Yeah.
So making it out, it has to be predetermined. It's predetermined, but it's actually predetermined according to the goal.
Yeah, yeah.
And in order to get there, you have to do X, Y, and Z all the time.
Yeah.
Perfecting the parody and all this kind of idea. Yeah. Which lies in the place of the nature. And the Buddhist teaching on
Yeah, it's interesting that if you look at this, this has been a particular point that's been tussled with since the beginning. If you look at the Buddha Vamsa, it's one of the earliest collections of the biographies of the Buddha in the late part of the Pali Canon. Every Buddha gives their biography, and every Buddha has a period of ascetic practices. Okay, but in every case, it's very short. It's only like 7 days or something like that. So different periods of time. It's only our Buddha who actually does 6 years. So again, you can see this attempt by the tradition to try to say, well, yeah, this, they did a bit of ascetic practices, but it wasn't really such a big deal. So So this is why this particular text is very interesting. I might also just mention that as a Jataka, it doesn't actually say how Jyotipala's practice went as a bhikkhu, okay, whether he's a good meditator or anything like that. Jyotipala, by the way, is the Bodhisatta, for those of you who have missed out on this thing that's revealed at the end of it, but Jyotipala is the Buddha in a previous life. And this sutta is referenced as another example of the gradual growing of the Buddha biography. One of the other suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya is the Acharya Bhuta Sutta. Now that tells the story from the Buddha's birth and the series of miracles at the Buddha's birth. Now the Pali version of that tells briefly of his reappearance in the Tusita heaven before the birth and then falling away from that. The Sarvasivada version of the same sutta then goes on to talk about his previous life in Gatikara, in the time of Gatikara and the Kassapa Buddha. So So there's this tendency to gradually extend this account further and further back. And clearly that shows that this story of Gatikara was one of the earliest episodes that was incorporated into that extended biography of the Buddha. So now come back to our sutta. King Kiki. Kiki appears elsewhere.
Stories from the Tiri.
Oh, okay. King Kiki, yeah. In the Pali Jatakas, it's usually Brahmadatta of Benares. But Kiki's the other one. So King Kiki of Kasi of course being the old name for Benares, you'll still see that around on signboards in Benares if you visit today. They still use Kasi occasionally.
Is he the historical?
Not sure. I kind of doubt it, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
It's a bit curious. I say, why do they say Benares? If the Buddha was in fact the previous son of the Buddha, surely the place would be called a different name.
Yeah.
But I find this just a curious little detail that the Buddha said this place was also called Benares, basically.
Yeah.
After the name, hundreds of thousands of years ago, maybe the place was sort of a town name convention.
So this is one of the characteristics of these texts. Everyone always speaks Pali, and all the place names and so on are all the same.
Yeah.
So it's a general assumption that the cultural conditions are the same in the past. So he had a number of state carriages made ready, and mounting a state carriage drove out from Benares to see the Buddha. Went as far as the road was passable for carriages, got down from his carriage and went forward on foot. Obviously he didn't have a four-wheel drive. If he'd had a Land Cruiser, he would have been fine. Yeah. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side, and the Buddha taught him the Dhamma, and then at the end of the exposition, King Kiki said, "The Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One, together with the Sangha of Bhikkhus, consent to accept tomorrow's meal from me." Blessed One Kassapa accepted in silence. Then, knowing that the Blessed One had accepted, he rose from his seat. After paying homage to him, keeping him on his right, he departed. Then, when the night had ended, King Kiki of Kasi had good food of various kinds prepared in his own dwelling. Red rice stored in the sheaf with the dark grains picked out, along with many sauces and curries. And he had the time announced to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. "It is time, Venerable Sir, the meal is ready." Then, it being ready, Buddha got up and went with the Sangha of Bhikkhus to have the meal. King Kiki served and satisfied the Sangha, headed by the Buddha, with the various kinds of good food. When the Buddha had eaten, the King Kiki took a low seat, sat down on one side, and then said, "Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One accept from me a residence for the rains in Benares. There will be such service for the Sangha." Second and a third time, King Kiki said, "Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One accept from me a residence for the rains." "Enough, King. My residence for the rains has already been provided for." So then the king was very disappointed and sad. So this is a kind of interesting, as a matter of Sangha policy and so on. And sometimes there's a feeling in the Sangha that in a way the Sangha is obliged to accept things that are offered. But the position, obviously in this case you can't if you've already accepted a residence, but Even in regard to other things, for example, if somebody offers robes to somebody and they already have them, then they won't just keep on accepting robes even though they have them. But they'll say, oh, that's very kind of you, but I already have the robes that I need. So this is a matter of monastic etiquette, that it's okay to very kindly and gently to refuse offerings if it's not something that you actually need to use. So even if it's the king. And he said, Venerable Sir, do you have a better supporter than I do? I have, great king. There is a market town called Webalinga where a potter named Gatikara lives. Now, of course, he is my supporter and my chief supporter. Of course, this is there's a political undertone to this, where the Buddha's saying, well, actually, this very humble potter is a better supporter than the king. Okay, so this is has a certain social political dimension to it. And now you, great king, thought that the Blessed One does not accept me a residence for the rains, and you are very disappointed and sad, but the potter Gatikara is not and will be not so. The potter Gatikara has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. He abstains from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct and sensual pleasures, from false speech, from wine, liquor and intoxicants, which are the basis of negligence. He has unwavering, so this is of course the five precepts, so he's gone for refuges, five precepts. He has unwavering confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and possesses the virtues of the noble ones. So these are the four qualities which are sometimes called the four factors of stream entry. Complete confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and the virtues loved by the noble ones. And that of course means keeping the five precepts in a way which is unblemished. He is free from doubt about suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So again, realizing the Four Noble Truths, again an indication that he's at least a stream enterer. He eats only one meal a day. He observes celibacy. He is virtuous of good character. So here he's going beyond the five precepts. He has laid aside gems and gold. He has given up gold and silver. And of course the idiom gold and silver is used here is the same idiom that's used in the Vinaya to refer to it. But when this is something which is sometimes used as a bit of a point of contention, I might just pull up the Pali for this. The Pali is Jata Rupa Rajata. Okay. So notice here that the thing it says that he's given up, what does it say here? He's laid aside gems and gold and given up gold and silver. And in the Pali text, gems and gold is mani suvarno, in the word for gold. And then he's given up gold and silver is jata rupa, being a word for gold. And rajata being a word for silver. So here's two different words for gold here in the same thing. But this idiom, jata rupa rajata, is actually explained in the Vibhanga of the Vinaya as basically meaning money of any kind, no matter what it's made of. Okay, so by the time of the Buddha, this had become an idiom, which basically just meant money, of course. Coin, old coin was mainly usually made of gold or silver, but even by the time of the Buddha there were other things, substances which were used to make coinage from. Yeah, wooden coins, and I think they say lac as well, maybe some other things. So basically means money, whatever it's made of. Okay, so that's just important to remember from a Vinaya context, because people will sometimes say that the Vinaya rule just means not having gold and silver, but actually it means not having money of any kind.
Yeah.
Ah, well, that goes a bit later. It talks about that. Yeah. Yeah.
One part of the day.
Ah, Ekabhattiko, yeah, that's also Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation.
Yes.
So you see here, we've got the translation by the same translator, and it differs from each other. So the... Which edition is that? You see, what year is it? You have to look at the year in the front. Is it? Yours is 95, this is 2005. So the reason why there's a different translation is because the Pali is a bit ambiguous. It says eka bhattiko, eka meaning one, bhattika meaning eater or meala. So to translate it literally, you translate it as one meala. Now if you were to work from a literal rendering of the Pali, that could be understood in many ways. It could mean that you eat only one meal. It could mean that you eat only one sitting or one session. It could mean you eat in only one part of the day. It could mean also that you eat alone. That probably is not the real meaning, but that's legitimate from the Pali. But eka bhattika, yeah, it really depends on the interpretation of that vinaya rule, whether it's assumed that people actually normally just ate literally one meal, or whether they eat in one part of the day, i.e. eating in the morning. In the origin story to that in the Majjhima we read some time ago, it actually seems that that it was the normal thing, or the recommended thing, was actually to eat one meal a day, and that the eating is like a breakfast or something was like a special allowance. And the Buddha says, okay, if you want to have some gruel or something in the morning as well, that's okay. But that was more like an extra. So, yeah, it could be interpreted both ways. Do you have an opinion about that? Oh,
yeah? Yeah, I think there's a translation also one meal a day.
One meal a day.
It's possible because it's in contrast with the another sutta.
Yeah.
He and Anagami.
Yeah.
And Anagami, they only eat one meal a day.
Yeah.
They have no more enjoyment or sense of pleasure.
Yeah.
They have only one meal a day.
Yeah, this is certainly more straightforward from the Pali, eka bhattika. Literally, one meal is what it means. Literally, yeah. He eats his meal in only one part of the day.
And what's the other translation?
He eats one meal a day.
Yeah. Later on, he divided and he gave it to one
meal
a day.
Okay, that's good. Where are we? Okay. Alright, so giving up gold and silver. He does not dig the ground for clay with a pick or with his own hands. What has broken off river banks or is thrown up by rats, he brings home in a carrier. And when he's made a pot, he says, let anyone who likes set down some selected rice or selected beans or selected lentils, and let him take away whatever he likes. So this is his business model. Yeah?
I think
he
doesn't handle money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Very pure livelihood, yeah? Yeah, it's a barter, yeah. It's a primitive economic system. Yeah. Very challenging. Right, perfect livelihood. But, there's at Giles's place, he's got a great book called Freakonomics. Anyone who wants to read it, if they're popping by Giles or sometime. But it's written by this economist who's done a number of quite extraordinary economic analyses of different kinds of situations, such as an economic and accounting analysis of a Chicago crack gang, for example, which was very interesting. He did one on this fellow who used to work for some big Wall Street finance company, and the guy got sick of his lifestyle and decided to quit. And so he said, well, how am I going to make my living? He said, I'll sell bagels. So he made a business where he would make bagels, and he would go to all of these corporations, and he would just simply put a tray of bagels down there in the morning, a tin, and say $1 per bagel. And then he'd just go off at the end of the day, he'd come back and collect the tin, how much money was there, and see how many bagels had been taken. Yeah, so that was his business. Okay, so he's still using money, so it's still not as good as Gatikara, but still it's pretty good. He's not checking on it, he's not forcing anyone to pay a dollar for a bagel, he's just supplying it there and trusting on people. Now, because he was an accountant, he kept meticulous records of every bagel that he sold and all the money that came in. And the upshot of it was that the average price he got for his bagels ended up being about 95 cents or something like that. So he got a bit less than a dollar, but of course he got far more than he would have if he paid somebody to sit there and collect the money, right? So if he would have only got like 50 cents a bagel or something if he'd actually been paying someone to sell it. And the other interesting thing is that he found that he got less money per bagel. The only relevant criteria was that he got less money per bagel the wealthier the business was. Right? So if it's in like a small family business, so they gave him pretty much a dollar, but if it's in a big corporation with billions of dollars, then they gave him less and less money. Yeah? So it shows that it's possible. Yeah? And this is a strong movement in modern times towards the thing they call freakonomics. Actually, it's two different words. I should clarify. That particular book is freak. That book is called freakonomics, as in what's good. That book is called freakonomics, as in you're a freak, F-R-E-A-K. Right? But there's another term called freakonomics, as in F-E-R-E-E, which is F-R-E-E. Yeah, it's a kind of computer. But anyway, F-R-E-E. Yeah. Freakonomics, as in giving things away, and that's actually become a major theme in modern economics theory because there's so much stuff given away on the web.
There's a movement, which is very similar, but he just started using it.
So the thing is that you know, human activity is never entire. You know, most human activity is not done because of money. Most human activity is done in a home or a family and friends, and people are doing things without having to use money all the time. But it's just that the domain of economics has gradually sort of colonized a lot of different realms which previously were outside of its sphere. So anyway, I like the fact that he's a bit of a radical. And again, there's a definite political undertone here, remembering that he's praising this fellow to a king, yeah? And so, yeah.
This is the caste thing rather than the caste thing. Even somebody who's basically a pot, he did in the dirt, basically.
Yeah.
Probably one of the lowest castes you can get.
Yeah.
And then there's this people he's virtues.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Showing that money has no place in the castes.
Yep. Yeah. And yeah, as you say, I mean, firing clay is one of the most basic of human technologies. You know? That's actually how they date, as it happens, that's how they date different strata of civilization in this period of ancient India, by the different kinds of pottery that they use.
I remember certainly it could have been quite a... I mean, do we know that it was such a low task? Would it be
extremely
important?
Yeah, like garbage collection is extremely important. Well, garbage collection is extremely important as well.
Like that.
Yeah, I don't think... I think that generally speaking it would have been a fairly basic level job. Yeah. Even today in places like India and so on, doing artisan's jobs, even if you're good at it, it's not a particularly high-class job. You go to where is it? Where the Taj Mahal is, and there's all the kind of, they're all doing the working in marble and stuff like that, and it's all pretty basic. Yeah, I'm sure it's a respectable, you know, business, but it's yeah.
There's a story, I don't remember if it's in Vienna, where one of the monks made himself a kutia out of clay, and the Buddha's very angry because if you burn clay,
yeah. Yeah, except he's making the point that he does not dig the ground for clay, but he's taking it from the places where there aren't going to be any animals in it. So the stuff which is broken off from the riverbanks and so on. Right? So he supports his... Okay, so let everyone set down some selected rice and take away whatever he likes. He supports his blind and aged parents. Having destroyed the five lower fetters, he is one who will reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final nibbana, without ever returning from that world. So in other words, he's an anagami. So he's basically reached the pinnacle of life as a lay practitioner. On one occasion, when I was living at Vayabhalinga, it being morning, I dressed and taking my bowl and outer robe, I went to the Potagadikara's parents and asked them, "Where's the potagon, please? Venerable sir, your supporter has gone out, but take rice from the cauldron and sauce from the saucepan and eat." I did so and went away. So, of course, this is another thing, is he doesn't have the food offered properly to him. typically explained as being that, well, certainly it's the case that in different came to different Buddhas, it wasn't necessarily the Vinaya that was laid down. But it's also the case, I believe, and I haven't researched this particular point, but I believe that apparently it's only the Pali Vinaya which insists that the food must be offered physically by hand. That's right. But if it was a Theravada monk, they'd insist that the blind parents came and offered. Anyway, okay. Okay. I did so and went away. Potagadikara came back and said, "Who has taken, not unlike Goldilocks and the Three Bears, right? Who has taken rice from the cauldron and sauce from the saucepan eaten and gone away? My dear, the Blessed One Kassapa did. It is a gain for me, it is a great gain that the Blessed One Kassapa had so much trust in me, and rapture and happiness never left him for a half month, or his parents for a week." So he was very happy at that. And the next time he comes back and asks for the same thing, and then he says, "Take some porridge," and he did that and went away, and the same thing happened. Odana. Odana is the rice, and supa is the soup. But the porridge is down here a little bit. Lamha is kumasa. Yeah, in the some of the other versions, he doesn't come back twice for the rice and the porridge. It's only mentioned once. And in the Sangha Bedavastu says that he sat cross-legged for 7 days experiencing only joy. Description insinuating that he was a jhana attainer, which you could imply from the fact that he's an anagami anyway. But that particular detail is not found in the Pali. On another occasion, when I was living at Vayabhalinga, my hut leaked. Then I addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Go, bhikkhus, and find out if there's any grass at the Potagadikara's house." "Venerable sir, there is no grass at the Potagadikara's house. There is the grass thatch over his workshop." Okay, so the Buddha obviously doesn't know. He goes there every day, but he's not aware if there's any grass there, and has to be told by the bhikkhus about what the building requirements are. "Venerable sir," he says, "go and take the grass from his workshop." Now that, yeah, that is a sign of faith, right? What if I was to say to you, Venerable Jug, you know, why don't you check out with Paddy if he's got any roofing materials? And he said, "No, he doesn't have, I was there the other day, he doesn't have any corrugated iron." And then you were to say, and I was to say, "I'll just take it off his roof." And
So
what do you prefer, to check out unconventional behavior? I think it's to give a very striking illustration of the faith of Gatikara. But probably, yeah. Then the Potagadikara's parents asked, "Because who's removing the grass from the workshop?" To which they replied, "Sister, the hut of the Blessed One Kassapa, accomplished and fully enlightened, is leaking. Take it, Venerable Sisters, take it, dear." Interesting that they reply, "Sister," talking to the parents, in the... where are we going? Is that the Pali version has... The Chinese versions have elders, not sister, then. Potagadikara went to his parents and asked, "Who has removed the grass from the workshop?" "The bhikkhus did, my sir, my dear. The hut of the Buddha is leaking." the Potagatikara thought, it is a gain for me, it is a great gain for me. The Blessed One Kassapa has so much trust in me. And happiness never left him for half a month or his parents for a week. Then that workshop remained 3 whole months with the sky for a roof, and yet no rain came in. Such is the Potagatikara. Well, exactly. Yeah, that point is actually addressed in the different versions. And now, okay, according to the Pali commentary, answers the question just raised by Venerable Jhana, it was not the Buddha's power, but the good qualities of the potter and his parents that kept the roofless building from being affected by rain. In fact, if the Buddha's power could have been such as to keep Gatikara's workshop free from rain, one might wonder why the same power did not suffice to keep the Buddha's own heart dry, thereby dispensing with the need to get grass roofing from Gatikara.
It seems a little bit
like
a treat for a Buddha to answer such a thing anyway. You know, even the depiction of the Buddha sitting under a tree, very nice, and he's asking for grass for his heart.
Where's the different Buddha? The earlier version.
Okay.
And he's creating
According to the Madhyama Aga version, the Sangha Beda Vastu and the Mahavastu, it means all the other versions, the Buddha, this Kassapa Buddha, highlighted the contrast between Gatikara, who was not at all irritated when the newly made roofing of his working place had been removed, or when his meal had disappeared, and King Kiki, who was sorely displeased when Kassapa Buddha did not agree to spend the rainy season at Varanasi.
It seems to be quite
disappointed and displeased.
Yeah.
That's a very strange comparison. Then King Kiki of Kasi dispatched to the potter Gatikara 500 cartloads of red rice stored in the sheaf and also source materials to go along with it. The king's men went to the Potagatikara and told him, Venerable Sir, there are 500 cartloads of red rice stored in the sheaf and source materials dispatched to you by King Kiki of Kasi. Please accept them. The king is very busy and has much to do. I have enough. Let this be for the king himself. Okay? And so finally there comes the identification of the birth. Now, Ananda, you may think thus. Certainly someone else was a Brahman student, Jyotipala, on that occasion, but it should not be regarded thus. I was the Brahman student, Jyotipala, on that occasion. This is what the Blessed One said. Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So it's also interesting, from a text historical point of view, that the actual identification of the birth really only comes just at the end and is not really intrinsic to the story at all. The main purpose of the story is the faith of Gatikara as opposed to the scepticism both of Jyotipala and the contrast between the humility of Gatikara compared to King Kiki, and the fact that Jyotipala was the Bodhisattva in a previous life is really neither here nor there in terms of the actual structure of the story itself. So I'm not sure at what stage that, whether that was part of the original sutta or not, but it's certainly part of the common tradition. In all versions, Gautama Buddha identified the young Brahman Jyotipala as one of his former lives. While the Pali version concludes at this point, according to the Madhyama Agama account, Gautama Buddha continued by highlighting that in contrast to his present life as a fully awakened Buddha, in his former life as Jyotipala, he did not reach perfection. And the Mahavastu continues by reporting how the monk Jyotipala, while in seclusion, developed the aspiration to become a future Buddha. So again, we see here the development of the Bodhisattva theory coming through in the telling of the story. Notice in the Mahavastu being a later text, through his telepathic powers, Kassapa Buddha became aware of this and called Jyotipala to his presence, informing the young monk that he should first make merit by offering a golden basket and robes to the Buddha and Sangha. Golden basket. Suvarna Pitakam Dushya Yugam. Pitaka could be an error for Pitaka and suggests the translation of basket. The Jonas Bhavar translates as seat of gold. And so it's either a basket of Pitaka or a seat. seat, Bita.
So where would a monk go to get some gold?
Well, again, this is evidence of later development in the Mahavastu. Once Jyotipala had carried out this instruction, Kassapa Buddha predicted that Jyotipala was destined to become a Buddha and will set rolling the wheel of Dharma and its three modes and 12 aspects in the deer park by Varanasi, a proclamation repeated by the gods up to the various celestial realms, including the Brahma worlds. Kassapa Buddha's prediction of Jyotipala's future Buddhahood recurs in other works, such as the Avadana Shataka, a Sanskrit collection of edifying stories from the past. Avadana Shataka, of course, meaning the 100 Avadanas, or the 100 tales. I believe, if I remember rightly, the Avadana Shataka is all Avadanas. It's on a set formula of them being told by Upagupta to King Ashoka. The Jataka Nidana Katha, a Pali biography of the Buddha, and this Jataka Nidana Katha is the teaching or the telling of the story of the Nidana, the source or the origins of the Jatakas. Okay, so this is the introduction to the Jataka. And the Buddhavamsa, legendary account of the lives of past Buddhas composed in Pali verses. It's one of the later books in the Pali canon. According to these works, the declaration of future Buddhahood that Jyotipala received on this occasion was in fact not the first of such prediction, but rather comes as a last step in a series of such proclamations. Okay, so here again we're seeing the development of the story. From the Mahavastu account, in the Pali account, there's no mention of prediction of the Buddha's future Buddhahood or anything like that. Mahavastu account says that that Kassapa made the prediction that he would become a future Buddha, and in other sources we find that prediction was made long, long, long ago. So again, the gradual development and expansion of this whole story. Blah, blah, blah. The Buddhavamsa traces such proclamations back through a series of altogether 24 Buddhas, beginning with Dipankara Buddha. It reports that at the time of Dipankara Buddha, a Brahmin named Sumedha made an aspiration to become a Buddha himself and lay down in the mud for the Buddha Dipankara and his disciples to walk over him. According to the Buddhavamsa, even at this considerably remote time in the past, Dipankara Buddha not only predicted that Sumedha would become a Buddha by the name of Gautama, but also predicted the names of his parents, his chief disciples and lay supporters, as well as the meal he was going to take on the eve of his awakening and the tree under which he would sit to become a Buddha. So notice that the act that he did there, lying down in the mud so that the Buddha could walk across him, now that's faith. The Buddhavamsa reports several other such predictions. Oh, it's better than some of them. There's one of the ones is my favourite one is where, I'm not sure if we'll talk about this, but my favourite one is where whoever it was thought, I need to offer something to the Buddha. I haven't got anything to offer, so the only thing I've got to offer is my own head. So he kneels down as the Buddha's coming and rips off his own head to offer to the Buddha as his aspiration for enlightenment.
How many actual references to Buddha's past lives or previous Buddhas, are there
in the
early part
of the suttas? Not many, half a dozen, maybe a dozen references.
So all of these are the ones blossomed.
Yeah. Most of the references are very just in passing, and there's a few that talk about it in some more detail. The Mahapadana Sutta is the main one. Yeah.
None of those contain future predictions.
Right, yeah. The Buddha wants, the idea of future predictions is entirely a later development. There's nothing at all in the Pali Canon, in the early part of the Pali Canon or the Agamas. Oh, except in, there is one or two in the Agamas. The Buddhavamsa reports several other such predictions, narrating how in a former existence the future Buddha Gautama gave golden sandals to the Buddha Konagama and his disciples. Or in another life as, okay, they're golden sandals, alright? So, let's... let's refrain from speculating about the possible fashion implications of this, right? Or in another life, as a universal monarch, he gave his entire kingdom and seven treasures to the Buddha Sujata, each time receiving a prediction of his pending Buddhahood. Okay, so the entire kingdom and the seven treasures, including the one of them is the woman treasure, and the elephant treasure, and so on. Anyway, not perhaps something to be reflected on in too much detail. Mahavastu similarly stretches far into the past and describes that the first time Gautama Buddha received a declaration of his future Buddhahood was when he was a monk by the name of Abhya under the under the Buddha Sarvabhibhu, the all-overcomer. Abhya had been jealous of the honour and esteem received by an arahant monk and had successfully spread the wrong rumour that this monk had committed adultery. To make up for this serious case of slander, Abhay went to a wealthy lay supporter and requested gold, with which he bought 100,000 pieces of perfume. After confessing his transgression and making an aspiration to become a Buddha himself, he sprinkled the perfume over the Buddha Sarvabhibhu and his disciples. And just as a word of warning, if anyone tries that in this monastery, right, they're going to be in serious trouble. But this has actually happened, and we did this water pouring ceremony for the Loy Krathong festival. They had this water pouring ceremony we did in Goulburn, the one I did in Perth a number of years ago, and all the lay people come and they're pouring water over the monk's hands, and this one woman has this big bottle of Giorgio Armani perfume for men, and pours this over the monk's hands, and we're like, what the. And we go back to our rooms afterwards, and we're like, oh, it wasn't just a drop or something, it was like the pure stuff just pouring. So that's right, exactly, after they've, anything like this. So anyway, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So the monk. So this one, he slandered another arahant. He's gone and asked for gold from a lay supporter, and then he buys all this perfume, and then sprinkles it over the Buddha, and then he says in the future he's going to be Sakyamuni. All right. On considering the Mahavastu and the Buddha monk's accounts, one cannot fail to notice a move away from the world of the early discourses. From the perspective of the early discourses, the idea of the Buddha who accepts gifts of gold and even the kingdom and the seven treasures of a universal monarch, which would, among others, also include the queen, strikes a strange note. Similarly, the idea that sprinkling a Buddha with perfume completes the accumulation of merit of a monk who has slandered an arahant to such an extent that he cannot be given future assurance of his future Buddhahood does not seem to fit easily into the thought world of the early discourses, says Venerable Analio in his understated academic style. The extent to which a bodhisattva can be given a detailed prediction of his future Buddhahood appears, moreover, questionable. For a Buddha with his powerful abilities, it may indeed be possible to predict that certain persons have reached such a high level of development that they will quite probably accomplish their aim, be this becoming an arahant or a Buddha. It would, however, not seem possible to predict exactly how this is going to take place, since this depends on a multitude of conditions that cannot be ascertained at present. To predict where and how in a far distant future a Buddha will give his first teachings, as done in the Mahavastu, or to predict the names of his relatives and disciples, as done in the Buddha Vansa, would only be possible if the future were predetermined. Such a deterministic worldview would, however, be at variance with the early Buddhist conception of causality. The future career of a Buddha is, as all events, something dependently arisen. It depends on a broad variety of different conditions, not only on the mental stage of development reached by the one who aspires to become a Buddha. Hence, it would not be possible to predict his future career in the way suggested by the Mahavastu and the Buddha Vansa. So I agree completely with Amalio's comments here. He has elsewhere written in more detail about some of these notions of omniscience and determinism. And I think it's a very important distinction that he's making here. There are certain places in the suttas where it talks about some of the things that the Buddha can do. One of them is that he knows the outcome of different ways of practice. This is in the Tanatanya Sutta. So he knows where all roads will lead. So he can predict that if you practice in this sort of way, it will lead to that kind of result. Okay? So this is this kind of general knowledge which is talking about here. But that's very different from a specific knowledge of saying such and such a time in the future, that, you know, this is going to happen and all of the details. And that kind of knowledge is never claimed by the Buddha.
Such as the practice
and all
the sets of practice.
Exactly.
Right,
exactly, yeah.
Forward. Yeah. Even then, he's that provider, if not pursued fully. In other words, if they didn't get a Buddha, that's not certain, they'll become a dog.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly the same kind of way that we can predict the future as well. Like we can predict a future that if you have a monastery where people come and they practice well, then the monastery will flourish. But you can't say exactly in what way it will flourish, yeah? These kinds of things. So this is the difference between the way the Buddha's knowledge is perceived in the early texts and the way it's perceived in the later texts. Such an aspiration by the Bodhisattva and a corresponding prediction is in fact not found in the early discourses. Oh, that's very interesting here. In this context, it is noteworthy that the Katawattu, now the Katawattu is the latest of the Pali Abhidhamma works, it's opposed to Shokan work which discusses controversial matters of interpretation of doctrine. The very fact that the Gatikara Sutta is quoted there shows how it was part of that discourse in that period of relating the early suttas to the emerging notion of the Bodhisattva which was being developed in that post-Ashokan period. But in that statement of the Gatikara Sutta, according to which the Buddha indicated to Ananda that he lived the monk's life under Buddha Kassapa for the sake of his future full awakening. And here's the quote from the Katavattu. Ananda, I lived the holy life underneath Kassapa, the Lord Kassapa, for the sake of full enlightenment in the future. As this statement is not found in the Pali and Chinese discourses, it seems safe to conclude that this apocryphal quotation in the Katavattu is yet another instance of the shift of perspective found in the Mahavastu and the Buddhavamsa. So that's a very interesting quote, and very interesting that it's referred to the Katavattu. Normally, in the Katavattu has about 200 discussions of doctrinal points. And in almost every case, it will refer in one way or another to the suttas, and the two parties in the dialogue will agree on what the canonical sutta passage is, but they will disagree about what the interpretation of it is. So this is why the Katavattu already assumes that the canonical scriptures are held in common among the schools. But in this case, which is quite unusual, it seems to be referring to an actual sutta which doesn't in fact exist in the Pali canon. Either being one which is dropped out or an apocryphal thing. A statement from a sutta, yeah, saying, you find this occasionally in the Pali later works, Neti Pakarana Petakopadesa, occasionally in the commentaries, that they'll quote as if from a sutta, but the sutta doesn't exist in the Pali canon as we have it. Whether that's a textual loss in the Pali canon, or whether it's apocryphal suttas, whether it's quoting from a scripture of another school, it's hard to say. That's fairly minor. It's only maybe 1% of quotes. Most of the quotes in the later texts do in fact refer to the suttas as we have them. Okay. The way that the early discourses in the Pali Nikayas and Chinese Agamas present the former lives of Gautama Buddha, one has the impression that his past existences are not yet perceived as necessary steps in his bodhisattva career, perspective that comes to the fore only with later works such as the Mahavastu and the Buddhavamsa. Jataka tales found among the early discourses, such as the Pali and Chinese versions of the Mahagovinda Sutta and the Mahadeva Sutta, conclude with the Buddha contrasting the absence of wisdom and realization in the spiritual life he undertook in his former lives to the presence of both in his present dispensation. The point here does not seem to be that he had to go through these former life experiences in order to become a Buddha. The message given by such discourses would rather seem to be that what he took to be supreme and important at those times, in view of what he has reached now, turns out to be an inferior form of practice and accomplishment. although in the case of the Gatikara Sutta, the spiritual life led by Jyotipala was actually conducive to wisdom and realization, the Madhyama Agama version of this discourse makes nevertheless the same point, presenting this past life of the Buddha Gautama as the young Brahman Jyotipala as yet another instance when he did not reach liberation. In fact, to treat the events described in the Gatikara Sutta from the perspective of the Bodhisattva's career is not without problems, as we have seen. One such problem is highlighted in the Milinda Bandha, which contrasts the events described in the Gatikara Sutta to another former life of the Bodhisattva as an elephant king reported in the Pali Jataka collection. According to the Jataka account, this elephant king had refrained from attacking a hunter who just viciously shot him with a poisonous arrow only because the cunning hunter had dressed up as a monk. Deep respect for the robe of a monk when being an animal in the far-off past stands in contrast to the rather disrespectful behaviour of Jyotipala, who, in spite of supposedly being a bodhisattva destined to soon become a Buddha, was not only disinclined to visit Kassapa Buddha, but even went so far as to disparage him. The conduct of Jyotipala described in all versions of the Gatikara Sutta does not seem to be what one would expect of someone who, over incalculable eons, had prepared himself to become a Buddha and was soon to bring this preparation to a successful completion. So again, notice that Nala is referring to a discussion as found in Milinda Bandha. Milinda Bandha again being a book from the post-Ashokan period of Buddhism, which discusses all of these kinds of problematic points found in the suttas and so on. And it seems to be quite a reasonable comparison that's being made there. From the perspective of the Gatikara Sutta and its Madhyama Agama parallel, the circumstance that Jyotipala was a former life of the Buddha does in fact not seem to be the central point of the tale. As I pointed out earlier, the central theme of the discourse appears to be the contrast between the potter Gatikara and the king of Varanasi, highlighting that due to his virtues, Gatikara was a better supporter than the king of the country. With the Mahavastu, however, attention focuses increasingly on Jyotipala as a stage in the Bodhisattva career of future Gautama Buddha, a shift of emphasis that finds explicit expression in the fact that the discourse on Gatikara has become the discourse on Jyotipala in the Mahavastu. So there's a shift in emphasis, and I mentioned before that there may be a political dimension to this. This is no doubt somewhat speculative, but one would imagine that a discourse which some way disparaged or slighted the role of a great king as a supporter of Buddhism might be less than politically expedient in the Ashokan or post-Ashokan period. Yeah? One could well imagine that such a discourse hailing from the early period of Buddhism, you might want to shift the emphasis away from the inferiority of the king in the post-Ashokan period. Towards the greater, so there's probably like a wanting to de-emphasize the king side of it, but also wanting to emphasize the Bodhisattva's career, as this became a subject of much greater interest in the Buddhist community as a whole.
Was the great Ashoka also the murderous Ashoka, or that was a different Ashoka?
Same one. Yeah.
Same one. So yeah. I can understand that's what people want to be running out the king and get one.
Yeah, well, this is the thing with conversion stories. Like Ashoka, you know, was very brutal and vicious and then converted to Buddhism. But there's always this kind of slight nervousness, you know, when someone had a great conversion like that, that they could possibly be reconverted. So, yeah, I can certainly, yeah, you want to be a bit cautious about it.
I thought it was whether due to the such power of the monk or the
there's different stories of his conversion, but yeah, in there's no stories now. The King Ashoka's time was later than the Buddha's, so there's no Agama stories on the King Ashoka. He's not mentioned in the Agamas or the Vinayas anyway. Yeah. There's not. No. Yeah, but not in the arguments. It would be in a later discourse. Oh, actually, no. You're right. There is actually the story of King Ashoka, and it is actually in the Samyutta Agama. Yeah. You're quite right, but it doesn't actually belong there. There's a quite a well-known textual problem with the Samyutta Agama, that they have by accident incorporated a large chunk of King Ashoka's biography in there, and this, it seems, occurred as a result of a librarian's mistake in China. And they took a bit of the Samyutta Agama out and put it in an Ashokan biography, it seems, because there's a bit of the Samyutta Agama that's actually missing some of the bits are missing, but instead this life of King Ashoka is put in there instead. And so, yeah, it's clearly a later text, and it's clearly just a textual problem, but that's all that seems to have happened. Someone's taken the wrong book off the shelf. It's kind of some mindless novice or something. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, everybody. Sorry? Yeah. Yeah. But that's an important point, because that particular point has been that's been pointed out and quite well known among the Japanese and Taiwanese scholars for many decades. And Master Yin Shun did detailed study on that, that's how I know about it. And he's reconstructed the sequence of the Sanyukta Agama to reflect the original form before that happened. But the knowledge that actually happened is still not universal, and you still find even in quite good scholarly works in the West that they will say that the Sanyukta Agama is later than the Pali Sanyutta Nikaya, precisely because it has the section of the Buddha's biography. So even Etienne Lamotte, who's probably the greatest Western scholar of Buddhism, or one of them. Ashoka's biography, yeah. Sorry, in there. And so they assume that that's actually a part of the text. It's actually not part of the text. It's just a filing mistake.
Do they find the missing?
No, the missing parts of Sanyutta are still missing, yeah. Some of them may have been recovered. Sorry?
The Ashoka biography, same library.
It's not there. Yeah, no, that version of the Ashokan biography is similar to other ones which are found elsewhere. Ashoka Vedana Suttas. Yeah, this is kind of a genre of texts on the Ashoka's biography which are fairly similar.
But was it? I think whether it was included in the Ekamakas. They were actually talking about how during Buddha's time, how Ashoka is a child. Having nothing to offer to the Buddha,
yeah.
Actually offered sand to the Buddha because he was building something with them. And that was how he became converted to building something in the future. I don't know whether there's a relationship to them, but it happened during the Buddha's time.
Yeah, so that would have been like a past life story of King Ashoka. I'm not sure, I'm not aware of that particular tale, but yeah, I'm not surprised that there would be those past life stories of Ashoka put in there. Yeah. So he offered some sand to the Buddha. Well, it's better than perfume anyway. Even without adopting the kind of perspective found in the Mahavastu and other later works, the fact that the Buddha Gautama in a former life was a monk under the Buddha Kassapa invites an interesting perspective on the awakening of Buddha Gautama. The Katawatu raises the question how far Gautama Buddha could have not had a teacher, as he indicated in the Aryaparayasana Sutta, or how far his awakening was an insight into things unheard before, as he proclaimed in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, if he had been a disciple of Kassapa Buddha. So again, this is another question which has been debated, and various perspectives on it from various teachings. So he's in a fairly recent past life, lived the holy life under Kassapa. He comes into this life. We know that he recollected his past lives before he became enlightened. Now, surely, if you're on the verge of awakening, the fact that in the past life before this one, only two past lives before, you'd actually been a monk under a Buddha, would have been, that would have been leaping up into your consciousness as a kind of extraordinary fact in your spiritual evolution. And if you're able to recollect your past lives, surely you'd be able to recollect the teachings in the Dhamma which you'd learnt there. There are various other places where it's indicated that this can happen. So if he was indeed a monk under Kassapa, could he recollect the teachings he got from Kassapa? And how, if that's the case, then how are we to reconcile that with his own claim when he's awakening that he had no teacher? He said, Acharyo me nati. And as he said, when he had an insight into things he hadn't learnt from another, and that particularly that idiom which Analia has translated, insight into things unheard before, it more specifically means insight into things not learnt from another. Ananusu tesu dhammesu.
Also, if to have a Buddha, the Buddha's previous teachings has to be off-gotten, how can that happen to the lifetime? It doesn't seem like long enough time to...
Remember, the intervening lifetime was in Tusita Heaven. So that was many, many thousands of years by human scale.
How many years previous?
Mythic time. Hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then
at the time of the Kasi, yes. I mean, I don't find that idea particularly implausible. I mean, it's still called Kasi today, so,
Yeah, but it's only 7,500 years, not
5,000. Yeah. Anyway.
And also, I think that, like, things need to be kept for longer as time goes by.
Mm-hmm.
I presume Sydney would be much longer than, you know, previous towns were, like, destroyed in much shorter periods. It doesn't make sense that just, like, 2,500 years now, you know, there'd be a place called... Still remember that there's a place called Kasi because there's, you know, there's computers, there's scriptures, there's writing, time records, and, like, information is preserved more than previously.
And so Analia goes on. Now, according to the traditional account, the Buddha's awakening was preceded by his development of recollection of past lives. Since his recollection of past lives formed part of his attempt to reach awakening, such recollection would probably soon focus on his former life as a monk under Kassapa Buddha. From the perspective of progressive recollection, his monkhood under Kassapa Buddha would have been the nearest instance in the past when he had been in contact with a teaching capable of leading to awakening. Commentary to the Gatikara Sutta indicates that Jyotipala had learned all of Kassapa Buddha's teachings and practiced insight meditation right up to the brink of stream entry. Hence, by recollecting the teachings of Kassapa and his former practice of insight meditation, Gautama would have had a first-hand experience of the liberating teachings of a Buddha to show him how to proceed to reach awakening. If this should be correct, Gautama would indeed not have been without a teacher. Hence, this proclamation to have no teacher may refer only to the fact that none of his teachers were still alive, and his claim to have realized what is unheard for may only indicate the liberating teachings had fallen into oblivion in the India at his time, either of which is what the actual text says. This way of interpretation would accord with a statement made by the Buddha on another occasion, according to which he had indeed merely rediscovered an ancient path trodden by Buddhas of the past. You can take that. This is Venerable Analio's suggested interpretation of a way of trying to make these things cohere. Personally, I don't think they do cohere.
In the actual sutta, there's no kind of all about Jyoti Pala's, the Buddha would have learned
You can't really say it, and it doesn't say anything. Leaves it fairly blank. I mean, personally, I think the most likely, I mean, as I said, the only real connection that you have that it actually was a past life. If you come down to the textual guts of it, is that little phrase there. That's it. It may be Ananda that you think. Certainly somebody else was the Jyotipala, the Brahmin student on that occasion, but that is not how it should be seen. I, on that occasion, was Jyotipala Manava. And that's a stock phrase found from the Jatakas and so on. So that's really what everything is built up on.
So, that seems to be two propositions there. One is that it's a textual theory, and that's just things happen in the end. So, the Buddha was not, in fact, driven by the past life. Or, the proposition that everything the Buddha says doesn't have to be in heaven. 100%.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit more acute than that. I think that I don't think that Analia's attempt here to try making consistent works. I think there's a clear inconsistency, and I think it's more than just something that can be explained away by being a different teaching according to context or according to time and place or something. You know, for him to say, and he made a sense, it's a central platform of the Buddha's teaching, that this is something I saw and discovered by myself. You know, it's absolutely central, you know, and it's a very unambiguous statement, acharya me nati, I have no teacher. And for him not to mention that in the context of the Kassapa Buddha ever, I find, you know, it's too much of a stretch to think of it as being reasonable. Yeah, I can't find any way of explaining it away. So, you know, perhaps that little text at the end is inauthentic. It's not really a Jataka story originally, perhaps. Or perhaps there's some other explanation. I'm not sure.
I thought that
the
same Buddha was meaning that in this lifetime I have no teaching to the extent.
Yeah, again, it could be. I just don't find that a plausible explanation. Like, particularly that the thing where he says in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, I mean, that's probably the most important passage. It's so central. And he says, Pubbe ananusutesu dhammesu. You know, and ananusutesu dhammesu, pubbe means in the past, and anusuta literally means heard from another or learnt from another. Yeah, regarding to Dhamma is not heard from another. And that's much more specific, because it's not just saying, okay, fair enough, in past lives, as with all of us, we have teachers, but he's specifically saying he didn't learn the Four Noble Truths from somebody else. Yeah? And so, but of course, surely he would have heard the Four Noble Truths under the time of Kassapa. So I find that, again, as I say, the text doesn't decide it, but I just find that I can't find that that's plausible.
Why do you think that the whole thing Buddha's, you know, like he's not one of the many Buddhas, what's the need for that?
Well, the need for that is because it's a part of humanity, it's not a part of a particular person. So it's not because of our Gotama's particular one-off unique personality. It's potential within all humanity, so that's a really important part of the kind of Buddhist self-image. That basically everyone is basically the same, you know, basically the same five khandhas and so on. And of course, in the later tradition, they call the Buddha nature, and it becomes much more explicit and much more important. But I think that's one of the important things. But also, it stems culturally from the universal belief in all Indian spiritual traditions that there were great awakened sages in the past. And as quite probably there were. We know that there were rishis and so on for thousands of years before. So there's this, I think...
It's saying Buddhism,
basically,
by saying
that there were before. Exactly, yeah. It gives it a kind of cosmic significance. Yeah, rather than just a local significance, yeah.
Yeah. In the does the Buddha ever refer to such as what the qualities of past Buddhas were? I know that I've read that there are sages in the past who had attained nirvana but chose not to speak of that.
Particular Buddhas, yeah.
Is it necessary to cast the
he was a Samasambuddha. Right. Yeah, he wasn't a particular Buddha, yeah. Even the fact that he had a Sangha shows that he was a teacher. Yeah.
So how should we approach the question of the degree of fallibility of a Buddha? So there's like instances of like teaching meditation about, you know, contemplation of the body and not killing themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And that's probably the worst one.
And then they're just simply going out of armchair and going out too early.
Well, that's one that gives me a lot of inspiration. I mean, these guys were complaining that I went for arms round at the wrong time. I'm like, this did it all the time. Come on. Come on. So.
You were saying that because he's made in the
No, I don't get the linkage there anymore. I'm not quite sure what they're saying.
So what I'm saying is that one theory is that it's a sexual problem and that it's not actually a younger story, but a story about the contrast between the potter and the king.
Yeah.
And then it's no problem, it's not a joke.
Yeah.
But if it is a joke story, it's the problem of the Buddha saying one thing, and then contradicts what actually happened in his life. And therefore, you know, solve it by saying that it's not a joke story, or even solve it by saying that the Buddha isn't always, he isn't infallible. He makes mistakes here and there. But the question then is the degree of fallibility. You know, is it possible for a Buddha to make a central part of his teaching that he hasn't heard something from another teacher? And kind of slip up and say, oh, I forgot about that.
That would seem a bit embarrassing, wouldn't it?
So how do you reconcile that?
It'd be like a copyright claim, wouldn't it, when he's coming out?
So we can accept as Buddhists that, you know, he slipped up and going arms around it early. We can accept as Buddhists that he can slip up on teaching the wrong kind of meditation of people with certain kinds of personalities.
That one's a bit, I have my doubts about. But I mean, generally speaking, the normal understanding is that for an ordinary arahant that they can make mistakes as regards to spiritual things, mistakes as regards worldly things, but not spiritual things. And presumably, with the Buddha, the important point is probably the same basic point, although it's generally understood that the Buddha's understanding both of spiritual matters and in some sense also worldly matters is sort of surpasses that of an ordinary arahant. Although actually in the suttas, the main difference that's pointed out between the Buddha and other arahants is not the scope of their knowledge, but merely the fact that the Buddha found his way there first. So this is the difference between whatever Captain Cook, who's the first one to sail from England, and everyone else who just hops on a cruise ship. That would suggest, if we take that seriously, that would suggest that we can make a similar kind of distinction in the case of the Buddha, that he could, he makes mistakes as to, ordinary facts of life and so on, but not as far as matters that are essential to spiritual practice are concerned.
How do you reconcile the sutras? What you're saying is that you don't release the last sentence
in the same way that you used to do it. It could be, yeah. Look, I don't have a firm opinion about it. I'm just pointing out that these different contradictions, and I don't feel that the explanations that are given for them are particularly plausible. That's one possible outcome, I don't.
And then the traditional explanations, the ones that
try to. Both the traditional ones, but also the explanations given by Nali and here. As I said, one of the fascinating things about this text is that it has generated such a response, and we've seen in all of the early texts, the Buddhist biographies, the Kathavattu, the Milindapanha, they're always kind of tussling with the implications of this particular sutta in one way or another. And and as we are now as well. Yeah, it's raising all of these kinds of questions. So this is one of the interesting things about these kinds of texts, is that so we shouldn't you know, don't see it as being a problem. These kinds of inconsistencies, they actually open up a lot of questions which are interesting to explore. I mean, as far as you mentioned also this thing about the murdered monks and so on, and that's another case. I mean, that case is more striking because it was a matter of, you know, Buddha's meditation instructions, and it was also one that was fairly harmful, one which, if any of us were to give meditation instructions with such results, we'd probably feel that we'd really messed up really badly. Yeah, didn't know about it or anything. And the interesting thing about that is it's both implausible to think that it actually happened, that the Buddha would have done that and it actually happened. It's equally implausible to think that somebody just made it up and put it in there. Because it shows such a bad light on the Buddha. It's completely contrasting. So again, that's why I don't have any particular theories on it, and I haven't seen any.
Can I have a printed copy of it?
Yeah, okay. Well, exactly. That's why it's not extraordinary to find that there are these problems. It's more extraordinary to see how few of them there really are. Okay, so let's finish by paying respects. And just as a little veneer point, just to point out that Venerable Jag just did the right thing. He saw the visiting Sangha arrive and came and went out and meet them and so on. That's one of the duties in Vinaya. So it's something to remember that when guests arrive, especially visiting Sangha, that there always should be someone to receive them.